Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2024 season. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water, and community. We pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging. In this podcast series, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2023, both adult and CYA categories, and other authors of historical fiction. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest literary award in Australasia, a heart-stopping $150,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories. My bottomless cup of peppermint tea is charged. Let's imagine the past.
Melissa Lukashenko is a Gori author of Bundjalung and European Heritage. Her work has received acclaim in many literary awards. A Walkley Award winner for her non-fiction, her sixth novel, Too Much Lip, was shortlisted for many awards and won the 2019 Miles Franklin Literary Award and the Queensland Premier's Award for a work of state significance. She writes about ordinary Australians and the extraordinary lives they lead. The exquisitely textured Eden Glassie was released in 2023. It's an immense pleasure to welcome Melissa Lukashenko to Imagining the Past.
Yeah, hi Greg.
How are you today?
I am pretty good. The rain stopped.
The rain stopped.
We've had torrential rain up here in the Northern Rivers on Bundjalung country, which is not unusual, but it is nice to see the sun.
I always like to start by just getting a bit of a sense of your, not so much career, but your interest in writing fiction. So when did you become kind of interested in writing fiction?
Oh, gee. If you mean professionally, it was in my early 20s, but I was always an avid reader. I never really understood that people could be writers. I think maybe as a teenager I might have understood that, but I understood that by reading about writers in the UK, because I grew up in a quite Anglo-centric era. And I do remember my mum gave me, for possibly my 13th birthday, a copy of a book by Monica Dickens called An Open Book, and that was her autobiography. And in there she spoke about being a writer. And I think it was about then that it dawned on me that being a writer was something that someone could be, but making that choice for myself certainly didn't wasn't remotely an option until I was in my mid-20s.
So what kind of changed in your mid-20s to change that view?
Well, two things. I'd been to uni by then. I worked for a couple of years in blue-collar jobs after I'd finished high school. Yeah. And then I went to university intending to learn. Well, I went into the business faculty, but came out the other end knowing how to put sentences and paragraphs together and understanding a whole lot more about economics and politics than I ever expected to. And I had also partnered up by that stage, and my husband at the time was a federal public servant, and we moved to Canberra for his work from Queensland. And because I didn't have a paying job in Canberra, we decided that I'd take time off and try and write, which is what I did, and that turned into Steam Pigs, my first novel.
Wow. Okay. So that's an interesting genesis for that. One wouldn't have credited Canberra with that.
Well, I think Bell deserves a lot of the credit. You need a room of your own, but you also need an income of your own.
Yeah.
Until that point, I certainly wasn't in an economic position to think about writing a manuscript that, I had no idea if it would be published. The whole world of publishing was completely opaque to me. But I got to have a shot at it, and that's the main thing.
So Eden Glassy is your first historical fiction. So maybe you could give us some insights into what the transition was like for you into historical fiction.
Yeah, well, it is my first historical novel. There have been elements of history in all my books because Aboriginal people are, if we are cultural people or knowledgeable people, then we're always keenly aware of what's happened to the culture and the historical forces that have brought us to where we are today. What happened? I think I finally felt ready to tackle the big themes of a book that I didn't think of it as an epic when I was writing it, but UQP, my publisher, very quickly slapped the label epic on it when it went to print. And when I looked up the definition of epic, it seemed to fit. You know, it's across several generations and takes in some sweeping themes across, you know, what's happened to this part of the continent, if not the entire continent. So I guess it was about feeling culturally competent to do that and getting the right permissions off the traditional owners, which is no easy thing, and feeling like I knew how to write a very good novel and so that I was ready to turn those or that skill set to something a little bit more complicated, I suppose.
So what kind of forms did your research take? I think of particular interest today for our listeners would really be the stuff around the oral histories that you used.
Yeah, well, there's a sense in which all of my cultural learning over, say, four decades has underpinned the book. And then I had to get specific permission off the traditional owners of Brisbane, and that had to come first because I knew without that permission I would just be making a pariah of myself in the Aboriginal community. So I approached the right people and initially got knocked back, as I've said elsewhere, and then instead of just going away and doing another project, which is what I normally would have done, I sat back on my heels and I thought, well, I really want to write this book, and I think it's I think it's necessary for me to write this book, and I really want it to be out there at the Bicentenary of Brisbane, you know, in 2024/25. And so I approached the traditional owners again and explained my reasons and what I really wanted to do with the project, and they relented in the end and said, okay, well, we trust you enough and we accept your credentials and we'll sit down and we'll share our information with you so that you can do it the right way. So that was one of the first steps for, you know, talking to people like Uncle Bob Anderson and Mrs. Pat O'Connor, and information I had from decades ago from Auntie Isola Best and a whole heap of people. All the elders I've ever spoken to have contributed to the book in a way. And then about during COVID, or maybe just before COVID, I was helping a Gilgambeh elder. She's passed now, but I was helping her with a private memoir of just some of her family memories, trying to collate them into a little bit of a thing for her family. And so I think that probably sparked a lot of interest in the history as well, although she was my mother's vintage, and maybe that was a big part of the Granny Eddie character, who's an exact contemporary of my mother, but also an almost exact contemporary of that Yulgambeh elder who I was talking to on about a fortnightly basis about what it was like for her growing up in Brisbane and taking trips out to Beaudesert and trips to the Gold Coast, and what it was like for Aboriginal people in Brisbane in the 30s and 40s and 50s.
So I imagine these conversations would have contained like immense amounts of detail and information. So did you actually record the conversations, or did you just try and write them down? And that once you kind of had these conversations, how did you get that information into a practical kind of usable form for you? You know, because it's a lot of information to hold in your head, to have in your head.
Yeah, especially when you've got a memory like a goldfish, which I didn't.
I think we're all circling the bowl now.
Yeah, pretty much. I do often record people when I'm talking to someone who I think has something particularly interesting to say.
But just do you record them with film or just, because obviously someone speaking and seeing them conveys a lot more.
Yeah, no, just on my iPhone.
Right.
But having said that, it's very rare for me to listen to that recording more than once. So, I've got the initial, listening, and then I might jot down a few notes out of that, and I might go back and listen to it again. But I think my iPhone's actually chock-a-block full of recorded interviews that I've long forgotten about, which I should go back and do something about.
Right. So you didn't transcribe them?
No, not those ones. Not those ones.
Right.
I have this practice of turning like fragments and very small snippets of information into bigger stories, or feeding them into bigger stories. What I do remember actually is talking about snippets. With Eden Glassy, I had the structure nutted out, more or less, the skeleton of the book, in about 2019, if I remember correctly, maybe early 2020. And this is the way I generally work with my books. But with Eden Glassy, I had the skeleton, and then I had what you might call fragments or dot points. And I always have a set of dot points that I want to use that speak either to character or to plot, or maybe to something else again. And with Eden Glassy, I had 16 pages of closely formatted dot points to insert into the skeleton of the plot that I already had. So, there's a huge amount of information. I still didn't get it all in. I'm still coming across bits and pieces now that didn't make it in. There's one that I'm going to have to use it in a keynote, I think, to Brisbane Writers Festival later in the year, because it's such a great image. And it may or may not be in Tom Petrie's reminiscences, but there's this image of cattle being driven across Palmerstone Passage, which is a very narrow saltwater passage between the mainland and Bribie Island, just north of the Brisbane River. And so some stockmen were driving a herd of cows across to the mainland or to the island. And there was a bunch of emus had decided to join them and swim alongside them. And I thought, that's just such a... I mean, for one thing, a lot of people don't know that emus could swim, but they can, or that they're in coastal areas, and they used to be. But, what I had intended was to use that as a metaphor that Molyneux would say to Tom Petrie. You might get him say, well, the emu might swim alongside the bullet, but it's not going to grow horns or udders, and it's going to remain, a creature of this place. It's going to remain itself. It's not going to turn into a European thing. But
beautiful image.
Exhaustion or just forgetfulness overcame me, and that didn't make its way into the novel, so I'll have to use it somewhere else.
So I've got a scattering
of those bits and pieces lying around.
Just going back to the collection of the oral histories, I'm just kind of interested too, did you feel like you kind of interviewed these people, or did you just kind of let them talk? So were you kind of asking things that you were looking for, or you were being told what there was?
I don't want to overstate the number of interviews that I did. The vast majority of what I did came through casual conversation with people, or ordinary conversation with people that wasn't taped. I did tape Uncle Bob Anderson, the Noggy Elder. I taped the elder that I was talking about in the nursing home. Obviously, I spoke to my mum at great lengths over many years. And there would have been maybe two or three others that I taped, but when I was taping people, it would be kind of a gently guided exploration, and they would have been answering my questions. But yeah, it's I probably would have been letting them wander down a whole lot of byways and sideways of memory.
Yeah,
that's where the interesting stuff is.
It's interesting when you get people going, and if you can prompt them with something, you can often open up something they've not thought about for a long while.
Yeah, and if I was more skilled, or if I'd thought of it, I probably would have asked people, you know, obliquely. I would have said, well, could you tell me about the, you know, if I wanted to hear about that thing with the cattle, I probably would have asked, you know, about the boats going over to Bribie Island or something like that. And then, because when you ask particularly old people, I've discovered, you know, if you ask them something directly, then they'll freeze up because they're worried that their memory isn't going to work, and then they'll start getting tense, and then you're wasting everybody's time.
So what other research did you do? Did you get yourself lost in the archives, or how did that go?
Archival work. I think actually going back to the early question of where it all started, in 2010, I was working on a project at the State Library of Queensland, not for the library itself, situated in the library. And the area where I was working was smack bang next to the John Oxley Library, which is where all the, you know, historical materials kept, of course. And that's probably as important as anything else in what prompted me to write the book, because I had access, you know, on a daily basis for almost 12 months to all those historical books, and not to the archives because they're out in a different part of town. But yeah, some archival research, and it's always fascinating to go to the archives. So, you know, there's always something, a little nugget of pure gold when you open up one of those manila folders. But it's very hard, unless you understand the systems, to know how to find what you're looking for as well. So it's great for a novelist or for a fiction writer, because you can open up any folders from any time before 1900 pretty much, and you know you're going to find something valuable. But if I use Trove a lot more when I knew what I was looking for, and I actually had to find it, because you can be a lot more sure of finding what you're after in Trove.
Yeah, and also just with the massive amount of digitalization now, newspapers, for example, it's amazing to just wander through a newspaper of the time, you know, of the days that you're writing about, and just see what was current.
Yeah, I think at the beginning of the Eden Glassy project, I optimistically hoped that I'd read the Moreton Bay Courier for every day of 1854 or 1855. And of course I didn't, but I definitely read a few weeks worth of the Moreton Bay Courier to get a sense of what was being sold and what was being, what was needed and what was making the headlines.
Yeah. And even I remember finding what food was being sold, you know, like, well, advertised in fruit markets and things like that. It was, So one of the differences with historical fiction must have been, like, having the fixed historical events to deal with. You know, when you're writing a story in the present, you're a lot freer of that. How did you kind of find dealing with, like, the framework of history?
Well, I gave myself an out on the front page of the book, of course, by saying it's a work of fiction and should be read as such, and also by centering the whole book around the hanging of Dunderley, and then, you know, compressing the action of almost a decade, you know, into the 2 years surrounding that. So I guess why not sticking to the letter of the law when it comes to, you know, the authenticity of dates. But I don't remember finding that difficult. What I found difficult was knowing that I was going to be criticised and possibly attacked by right-wing historians for not getting the history right. So, you know, I went to great pains to understand the era, and then I read something the other day that made me realise that I'd left out some component of colonial history. I can't remember exactly what it was now, of course, because of the goldfish thing, but something to do, like, what was happening in England at the time. It was about separations happening, and it wasn't separation, but it was something of that kind of significance, and that I hadn't even touched on in the book. But I got a lot of it in there, you know. I got the labor shortages, I got the presence of the Chinese, I got
the importance of separation. And I think I managed reasonably well for someone who's not a historian with my portrayal of the era.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, you're between two covers, aren't you? There's kind of just limits, I think.
Yeah, well, there's limits. There's word limits. There's creative limits. There's, not intellectual limits. What am I trying to say? Scholarly limits, I suppose. But I will sit down with someone like Ray Kirkhove or Ray Evans at some point and, you know, ask them what they reckon. I think Liz Connors, I did ask Liz Connors what she reckoned, and she thought I'd got it pretty right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm always interested too in how much one project kind of pollinates the next or other projects. So would you or could you, do you think, have written Eden Glossy without Too Much Lip?
Well, Too Much Lip did wonders for my confidence because it was received so well. So, probably not, actually. Probably it was the boost I needed. And, it was certainly a springboard in terms of what I thought I was doing, what I thought I was capable of doing. I always remember Kate Grenville. I read The Secret River in draft. She sent it to me because I was involved with that book from the beginning. And she sent me the draft and she said, it was like the 40th draft or something. And she said, look, I've got no idea if this is any good, but have a read of it. Let me know what you think. And I wrote back and I said, well, you know, it's quite brilliant. But you don't necessarily know as a writer what you're doing or what you've achieved at any given point. So when I wrote Too Much Lip, I thought I'd written a pretty good novel, but I had no idea that it was going to win the Miles Franklin or be received as being a work of that kind of standard. So, I was kind of gobsmacked by that. But then, if that's what people reckon, then I can do a whole heap of other things. I can go off in any direction.
It just felt for me like with Too Much Lip, you kind of achieved an intimacy in the family life that kind of seemed to carry over into both kind of time periods of Eden Glossy.
Oh, that's great. That's great to hear. Yeah, Too Much Lip was partly modelled on my own family. I think most fiction writers use their friends and family more than they admit. And, one of my older brothers was caring for my mum as I was writing Too Much Lip, or just before I was writing Too Much Lip. And a lot of that relationship made its way into the book. So it was very easy to get the flavour of it, to get the sensibility.
Yeah, I think friends and families of writers are always trembling, really.
Yeah.
As we've kind of mentioned, the novel's a split timeline. There's one section in 2024 and the bulk of the other part is in 1854-55. What were some of the decisions you made around establishing the dual timeline?
Well, the reason for the dual timeline was because I needed living, breathing Aboriginal people in the current era. Otherwise, I knew that the book would be misinterpreted as an elegy or a eulogy for a society that's definitely not dead. And that's simply going on a reading of, the way my work has been received or misreceived over the decades. So it needed the modern characters so that no one would be misled either in Australia or overseas to say all these terrible things happened and, black fellas are mostly gone or entirely gone, which is, still unbelievably what some people like to think. So that was the only reason I included a modern timeline. Otherwise, the whole book would have been set in the 1850s.
Right.
And then originally I was going to go into, I was going to bring it through the 1850s and up into the 60s to the time of the Great Fire of Brisbane. And I make a very brief allusion to that towards the end of the book where Gudja Iris is talking about Nita's story to the modern day characters and saying she's got a story of her own. about being rescued in the Great Fire of Brisbane and so on and so forth. I was originally going to write that out, and I originally was going to end the book on a scene with Nita, but ended up deciding to cut it and do it the way it's ended up.
You've kind of spoken about this a little bit, but the novel was first published in October 2023, and yet, as we've said, there's a portion set in 2024. So you must have had to finalise the manuscript in early 23. Yeah. I'm just wondering what the ideas were around writing about 2024 in a kind of speculative manner, and weren't there some kind of risks in doing that?
Yeah, there was probably the biggest risk during the writing of the book was not knowing what was going to happen with COVID, because COVID was in full flight. And even though COVID's a terrible thing for the world and, tragic for many, many hundreds of thousands of families, for me it was in some ways a gift, because I got to just hunker down for that 12 months or maybe even 18 months, and everyone else was hunkering down, and I just had fewer demands on me. I didn't have to go to festivals. I didn't have to travel or do anything except research and write. But in terms of where the book was going, I had to just, assume and hope and pray that COVID would be done by the time the book came out, by 2024. And, I was driving through Brisbane the last week, I think it was, and realised that they're putting a footbridge across from the CBD across to Kangaroo Point. And in the modern era, there's one more bridge across the river than I've actually accounted for.
Right.
So that's something that's missing. But those were the main things, I think, in terms of risk. And it had to be 2024 because Oxley first came up the river in 2023, in his terms, discovered it in inverted commas.
And in 1823.
Sorry,
you said 2023.
Oh, sorry, but 1823.
I'll just do another lap of the goldfish bowl.
Yeah, so Oxley first came up the river in 1823, or first sighted it. Then he came back in 1824, and I think it was 24 that he decided it needed a new name. And in 1825, the Redcliffe settlement under, I think, Commandant Miller was set up north of Brisbane, and then a lack of fresh water, plus the local traditional owners chased them out pretty unceremoniously, and so the settlement shifted to where Brisbane currently is, and so that was 1825. So I had to set the modern action of the book in 2024, otherwise the bicentenary stuff wouldn't have made any sense.
Yeah, I just kind of wonder how it will be interpreted in 2034 or beyond, because there have been some fairly significant world events that have happened since you must have finalized the manuscript, for example the Gaza-Israel conflict, even The Voice.
The Voice, it was pure coincidence that I used The Voice as the name for the kind of monster or bogeyman that's dogging Winona. That wasn't intentional at all, but I decided to leave it in, even though it was obvious by the time the book went to print that The Voice was going to mean something else to an audience in 2024. Gaza and Israel, it's... I think that's been around for decades, and
there's truth in that. Yeah,
probably will be around for decades to come, unless Palestine can achieve statehood, which fingers crossed.
Mm. So the other setting is 1854-55, and in my notes I've written an era of trust and dependence, and maybe that's yours and not mine, but it was in my hand. But it was an interesting crossroad that time. It as you've told us about the arrival in the area of Brisbane, by that time of 54-55, languages were known. Like Tom had Tom Petrie had crossed into the First Nations world, but also Melanion spoke English. And I just can't help thinking about William S. Burroughs with his idea of language as a virus. So, you know, it was like First Nations people had been infected by this Germanic language with this Latin overtone. So I'm just wondering what, and also words from First Nations languages had gone back into English as well, not just place names, but I think actual objects. Like I grew up in Tasmania, and the word dilly bag, which I understand is a word from the area around Brisbane, was used regularly in Tasmania.
Yeah, dilla means mat rush, like lamandra, and so that's the origin of the term. Yeah, and
so I'm just wondering what these intertwining of languages kind of tells us.
Well, it tells us that you know, like everywhere else in the world, where different cultures and peoples meet, that they will try to communicate whatever way they can. One of the scenes that, again, you know, I had envisaged for the book, but which didn't make it in, was I was thinking that Tom Petrie would encounter Davis, whose Aboriginal name was Durrumboy, the white man who had been out in the bush living with Aboriginal people for 17 years before he came back in, and that the two of them would converse in Aboriginal languages in the middle of the town. Rather than in English, but again, that's something that just got left by the wayside. I think it'd be a mistake to think that 1854, 1855 was entirely peaceful in Brisbane. What had happened by then was that the Yerrans people, who were in the book living at the South Bank, had been pushed over from the CBD area. That's where the Yagara people originally were. And they were, presumably some of them were shot or died from disease. But the ones who were left were pushed across the river away from the main white settlement at North Brisbane. And there had been killings. So there was definitely killings at Kangaroo Point. And there'd been frontier conflict, but it had happened a generation earlier, which is why I set the book in that era, because I wanted to not write about first contact and first conflict, but about what came in the aftermath of that. So Brisbane itself was pacified, I suppose you could say, but immediately outside Brisbane wasn't, and that's made obvious by the events of the novel.
So maybe just a few crafty questions. You've kind of alluded to the fact that you like to plot and plan.
I don't like to. I'd love to pick up a stylus to just rip off a 90,000-word novel without having to go through the agony of planning. Fortunately, it doesn't work that way.
I once saw the plan of Dickens' David Copperfield, and it was so down to the minutest levels, you know. It was like two columns. He had the events in one column, and the second column was what they meant, you know, how they... But it was the novel. It was the whole thing. But when you think about how Dickens wrote, he was always moving around. He was always travelling. So and it was all serialised. So things were being printed before he'd finished. So he really did have to be pretty exact with his planning. But so do you like your first draft, or is that like blood on a stone?
Do I like writing first drafts? Yeah. No, it's like pulling teeth. But that's interesting what you say about Charles Dickens, because it was serialised. I would have thought that it was a lot more seat of the pants type stuff. But
what I saw in this, it was mapped out, and he then just had to churn it out, really.
Oh, well, I'm in good company then. Well, the plotting is difficult and painstaking, and you know, I took the better part of 12 months doing research and getting the structure right for Eden Glassy, because every time I finished a book before, I've thought, well, that's great, but what if I'd thought to do that? And what if I thought to do this? And I thought, wouldn't it be great to get to the end of a book and not have those questions, you know, not have those regrets? And by and large, I don't. It's because I took so much trouble and effort over the plotting. But no, first drafts are horrible, horrible things. And the editing of a first or a second or third draft or thereafter is much more enjoyable. And then you go and you take your lovely finished book to the publisher and you say, here's my masterpiece. And the editor reads it and they says, great, we love it, fantastic. And this is what we want to do in our structural edit. And that's when you lose the will to live.
So when you're doing that first draft, how many words do you aim for in a writing session, or do you just, whatever happens, happens? Because, you know, a lot of people try to aim for as little as 500 words a day.
Now, look, it's all a bit of a blur, really. I think, I know some people aim for 1,000. I think 1,000 sounds a bit optimistic, but I'm sure some days I wrote 2,000. I think generally I work in a sort of an organic way, and it just maybe I try and write a scene, but then some scenes are 3,000 or 4,000 words, so that doesn't make a lot of sense. Well, yeah, sometimes it would be 500, sometimes it would be a couple of thousand, sometimes it might only be 200 or 300. You know, yeah. Day when I'm struggling.
But it's just
I've had writer's block at the moment, and I'm writing a contemporary short story at the moment. No, actually, it's not contemporary. It's set before colonization, but it's satirical, so it's got a kind of contemporary feel to it. And I've written about 700 words in a fortnight because it's really coming very hard, but I'm really happy now because I've got 700 or 800 words down.
And you've got something to massage. You've got something to need. You've got something to knead now.
And I've got my characters more or less sorted out, and I've kind of got the shape of the thing, and that's what's important, is the shape.
So when you're moving between your first, second and third draft, are you always trying to complete a first draft or before you start revising, or are you kind of happy to jump back and forth? Because I used to feel it was such a change of gear, you know, to go back to the beginning and start again rather than trying to finish the end.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Historically, that's what I've done, is gone straight through from beginning to end. And I was listening to my mate Chris Neen on a podcast yesterday saying that, I can't remember if they were saying that they do that or don't do that now, but one or the other. And I was thinking, they must have been saying that they don't, that they jump around. That's right, use Scrivener, which I've never used, because then you can paste between different chapters and whatnot. And that idea horrifies me. I've always started at the first page of chapter one and ended on the last page of chapter 20, whatever you get up to. But with In Glassy, I think it's something to do with getting older, but I didn't do that. I revised as I went along, and like the whole process was slower than most of my books. It was a year in the researching and plotting, and then 3 slow years of writing. And I did a hell of a lot of revision as I went, and I've never done that before. So that was different. Just goes to show you can teach an old dog new tricks.
So when you're redrafting, how much do you kind of think about your reader, and you know, how much are you conscious of entertaining them as the writing's unfolding?
I'm conscious of giving the reader a good time when I'm plotting, and also of saying what I want to say and what the book needs to say. And then when I'm doing the writing, like filling the skeleton in, it's about language and making the language both beautiful and clear. You know, I think there's probably 2 sentences in Eden Lassie that aren't very clear. And I remember thinking, oh, there's 2 or 3 sentences here that aren't crystal clear, but I think they need to be the way they are for some other reason. But apart from that, I like to be very transparent and not have any sort of complexity or jargon in between me and the reader. And that way the story gets to hit them, you know, head on like a Mack truck. When the language is both beautiful and very, very simple.
Yeah.
So that's what I work at in drafts 1 through 10.
Yes, the endless drafting.
Yeah.
Your characters are really rich and human. They're full of promise and fault, which I think is the mark of great writing. So how did you kind of arrive at the historical characters? Did you, at any point kind of create amalgams of a couple of people into one character? And how did you kind of find their voices?
Winona's voice came very easily because I know a couple of young Aboriginal women in Brisbane that are exactly like Winona. So that was not difficult at all. Granny Eddie was largely my mum with some other elders folded in, some stroppy kind of elder women that I've known in my adult life. One of whom is Auntie Barb Cummings in Darwin, who's gone now, but she was an early influence on me in the 90s. And then Mullinyan was the most difficult because of his gender and his age and the fact that he was a tribal youth at the actual, just after the point of colonisation. So he's the most distant from me, probably. In terms of the main characters that I was trying to write, apart from maybe Tom Petrick, for him I had to look at my nephews for the youth and the masculinity and the culture, the almost classical culture that he was inhabiting. It was just a matter of trying to do my best rendering of pre-contact culture point of contact culture that I could possibly summon. So, I haven't had anyone tell me that I'd buggered anything up yet. So,
as I said, for me, they all had faults. They had promise and fault.
Yeah.
I think often, people see historical characters through, the European men just become like Dickensian caricatures kind of thing. And whereas I kind of felt like all your cast were really well formed.
Well, that's good to hear. That's, the book's selling really well, so people seem to like what I've done with the characters anyway.
Good. This is maybe a bit of an odd question, but in the small time I kind of had as a writer, I'd not been able to get a publisher, so I published 4 novels on my own. But it soon became very apparent to me that I was that self-publishing was my claim rather than the novels that I'd written. People were always asking me how I did it. Was it hard? How much money did I make? I'm just wondering how you feel.
Or fools.
I know. My response was go and clean toilets if you want to make money, really. How do you feel about being identified as a First Nations writer? And what are the kind of ups and downs of that label?
It's accurate, I suppose. And if it helps people that want to read Indigenous writing find my work, then that's a good thing. I guess it's not either or. I could be a First Nations writer and I can be a writer on the global stage. Possibly it's only in Australia that people think that that's not possible, that you have to be something lesser or deficient to be a First Nations writer.
I'm not sure that it's lesser or deficient, but it just seems, particularly the media and the way things are marketed, it's all about boxes. It's what shelf do you kind of sit on?
I think I sit in the fiction area at Avid Reader in Brisbane, as well as probably in the First Nations bit. And I'm sure it's not deficient or defective. It's just a matter of whether people think that label makes you that. I don't sort of spend a lot of time thinking about that sort of thing, to be honest.
Well, do you think you'll ever write something that's not based in a First Nation situation or character?
Possibly. I'm going to write a crime book one of these days. I promised the old ladies in a Scrabble club that I set up many, many years ago that I'd write a a Scrabble murder mystery called Blood on the Tiles. And I will do that before I die. That won't necessarily be an Aboriginal story.
I think we've all played those games of Scrabble. Yeah.
I don't know. I wouldn't rule it out. But everything I write is going to be Aboriginal writing just because of, you know, who I am.
Well, of course. Yeah. But I just kind of meant more the situation of the novel.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I heard an interview with Tony Burch the other night on Late Night Live, and he was kind of talking about, you know, that First Nations people should be able to, you know, critique anything rather than just be critiquing First Nations writing. And, you know, of course, that's completely true. Like, you know, it would be great if, you know, a First Nations person wrote a Roman history or something, you know, and brought a completely different slant to that.
Yeah, well, Gorky Park was by a Native American writer.
Mm, that's true.
Yeah. The trouble is numbers, because, you know, First Nations novelists, we want our work to be reviewed by Aboriginal critics, and that means, you know, we don't get asked a lot to review other work, although I do. It's just a matter of not having the numbers to go wider at the moment. You know, there's only a handful of us doing that kind of work.
But there's great need now for sensitivity reading, but often this is just restricted to areas of race and religion. Like a friend of mine wrote a novel involving Jewish people that was subject to three often contradictory sensitivity readers. So I'm just wondering, you've spoken about getting permissions and things, but did you kind of move through that process at all with this?
Everything I write is written with various Aboriginal elders in the front of my mind saying, well, why did you say that? And what do you mean when you're saying that? And do you really think that that's wise to put that down? So as a cultural person, I've got my internal sensitivity reader or cultural reader, I suppose. I mean, I do some of that sort of work more in film and television than in literature. In fact, I very rarely do it in literature these days because people are fond of, you know, getting the report, then going off and doing what they want anyway. So it's kind of a waste of my time and a waste of their time. But it helps. It's damage control. That's how I see it. It's damage control. You get to weed out some of the most egregious racism and unconscious white supremacy that people bring to their work, which is rife, you know, because
Well, it's still there. It's still...
Yeah, and it'll still be there until people start to understand, you know, who they are, what colonization is, and the fact that they are, if you're writing Aboriginal characters, that you're actually writing on the frontier. But people are still pretty clueless about all that stuff.
Yeah. And one quote in the novel I found kind of interesting was the reference to the drowning Mark, which is a quote from Shakespeare's The Tempest, which is a pretty loaded play if you think of it in terms of colonisation.
Absolutely.
So I'm just wondering what your ideas were around referring to this.
Well, in the front of David Malouf's Jono, he quotes... he has a quote about the drowning Mark. And so I used that as a kind of pointer to that being famously the first Brisbane novel, and then mine being the most recent Brisbane novel. And I wanted it's about Aboriginal philosophy, and I deliberately left the question up in the air in the book, and I left it unanswered because I don't know if you remember, but in the scene where Mullinyan and his father first arrive at Woolloongabba at the Pullum, his father is asking him questions, and he gives an answer, and his father says, yes, that is the skin of it. Now show me the bone. It's like you've reached the first level of understanding, but show me the next level down. And so when I was talking about the drowning Mark, I was circling back to that idea and that practice in Aboriginal philosophy where you are expected to nut things out for yourself, where you're not given information on a platter. And yeah, I'll just leave it at that.
What do you think it is that really sets your writing apart?
Oh, that's a big question.
I don't know.
Modesty forbids me. I guess there's only a small handful of people in Australia writing that have a deep and broad understanding of First Nations culture and are also writing fiction, literary fiction. The numbers are increasing. But there's probably not more than a dozen of us at the moment. And what sets mine apart is that I'm doing it in southeast Queensland, the third biggest city of Australia, fastest growing urban area in the world, I believe, the area between Yagara country and Brisbane and Yugga Bear country on the Gold Coast. It's the most rapidly urbanising part of the planet, which you can tell by the roadworks that drive everybody insane if they're living in the area. So, that's probably the best answer I can give you there.
Right, just to finish up, what are you working on now? I mean, you've given us a few hints, and I'm always interested, and you have kind of hinted at this as well, that do you think there'll ever be a pre-colonial novel?
I'm sure there will be if there isn't already. I think Archie Weller over in WA might have, I don't even know if he published it, or he certainly had a manuscript for a pre-colonial novel a long time ago.
Right.
Margabala may have published it. Yeah, there's probably half a dozen sitting in people's drawers around the country, and those will be published. But what my fear is that they'll be written by people that don't understand the classical culture, and who give rise to a whole new set of incorrect stereotypes and incorrect assumptions about us.
Yeah.
If you don't know what you're talking about, leave it alone. It's my golden rule. So it probably won't be written by me, but I'm sure it will be written. And for the time being, I'm going to keep working on this collection of my short pieces, some published already and some not, that will come out hopefully sometime next year. And my short story that I'm working on called Murray Invents the Wheel.
So you haven't got a novel project on the go at the moment, or are you just thinking about something?
Blood on the tiles. Crime is calling me.
All right. Well, I'll have to do a crime fiction podcast.
Okay. Thanks, Greg.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. I enjoyed our conversation.
No worries. See you. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2024 season. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find interviews with many a luminary. Subscribe to the podcast series wherever you listen to be notified when new episodes drop. Also, visit our website, hnsa.org.au, subscribe to our newsletter, and join our Facebook group to be effortlessly up to date with all that's happening in historical fiction. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.